Chapter 39. Ortega had a variety of news. Irene Elliott had called in a location and said she was willing to talk about another run. The call had come in on one of the tightest needle casts Fell Street had ever seen, and Elliott said she would only deal directly with me. Meanwhile, the Panama Rose patch-up was holding water, and Ortega still had the Hendrix memory tapes. Cadman's death had rendered Fell Street's original case pretty much an administrative formality, and no one was in any hurry to tackle it anymore. An internal affairs inquiry into how exactly the assassin had been pulled out of holding in the first place was just getting started. In view of the assumed AI involvement, the Hendrix would come under scrutiny at some point, but it wasn't in the pipeline yet. There were some interdepartmental procedures to be gone through, and Ortega had sold Marawa a story about loose ends. The Fell Street captain gave her a couple of weeks open-ended to tidy up. The tacit assumption was that Ortega had no liking for internal affairs and wasn't going to make life easy for them. A couple of IAD detectives were sniffing around the Panama Rose, but organic damage had closed ranks around Ortega and Bautista like a stack shutdown. IAD was getting nothing so far. We had a couple of weeks. Ortega flew northeast. Elliot's instructions vectored us in on a small huddle of bubble fabs clustered around the western end of a tree-fringed lake, hundreds of kilometers from anywhere. Ortega grunted in recognition as we banked above the encampment. You know this place?
Places like it. Griftatown. See that dish in the center? They've got it webbed into some old geosync weather platform. Gives them free access to anything in the hemisphere. This place probably accounts for a single-figure percentage of all the data crime on the West Coast.
They never get busted?
Depends.
Ortega put the cruiser down on the lakeshore a short distance from the nearest bubble fabs.
The way it stands, these people keep the old orbitals ticking over. Without them, someone would have to pay for decommissioning, and that's kind of pricey. So long as the stuff they turn over is small scale, no one bothers. Transmission Felony Division has got bigger disks to spin, and no one else is interested. You coming?
I climbed out, and we walked along the shoreline to the encampment. From the air, the place had had a certain structural uniformity, but now I could see that the bubble fabs were all painted with brightly colored pictures or abstract patterns. No two designs were alike, although I could discern the same artistic hand at work in several of the examples we passed. In addition, a lot of the fabs were fitted out with porch canopies, secondary extension bulges, and in some cases even more permanent log cabin annexes. Clothing hung on lines between the buildings, and small children ran about, getting cheerfully filthy. Camp security met us inside the first ring of fabs. He stood over 2 meters tall in flat work boots and probably weighed as much as both my current selves put together. Beneath his loose gray coveralls, I could see the stance of a fighter. His eyes were a startling red, and short horns sprouted from his temples. Beneath the horns, his face was scarred and old. The effect was startlingly offset by the small child he was cradling in his left arm. He nodded at me.
You Anderson?
Yes. This is Kristen Ortega. I was surprised how flat the name suddenly sounded to me. Without Riker's pheromonal interface, I was left with little more than a vague appreciation that the woman beside me was very attractive in a lean, self-sufficient way that recalled Virginia Vidora. That, and my memories. I wondered if she was feeling the same.
Cop, huh?
The ex-freak fighter's tone was not overflowing with warmth, but it didn't sound too hostile either. Not at the moment, I said firmly. Is Irene here?
Yeah.
He shifted the child with his other arm and pointed.
The fab with the stars on it. Been expecting you.
As he spoke, Irene Elliott emerged from the structure in question. The horned man grunted and led us across, picking up a small train of additional children on the way. Elliott watched us approach with her hands in her pockets. Like the ex-fighter, she was dressed in boots and coveralls, whose gray was startlingly offset by a violently colored rainbow headband.
"Yo visitors," the horned man said. "You okay with this?"
Elliot nodded evenly, and he hesitated a moment longer, then shrugged and wandered off with the children in tow. Elliot watched him go, then turned back to us.
"You'd better come inside," she said.
Inside the bubble fab, the utilitarian space had been sectioned off with wooden partitions and woven rugs hung from wires set in the plastic dome. Walls were covered in more artwork, most of which looked as if it had been contributed by the children of the camp. Elliot took us to a softly lit space set with lounging bags and a battered-looking access terminal on a hinged arm, epoxied to the wall of the bubble. She seemed to have adjusted well to the sleeve, and her movements were smoothly unself-conscious. I'd noticed the improvement on board the Panama Rose in the early hours of the morning, but here it was clearer. She lowered herself easily into one of the loungers and looked speculatively up at me.
"That's you inside there, Anderson, I presume."
I inclined my head.
"You're going to tell me why?"
I seated myself opposite her. "That depends on you, Irene. Are you in or out?"
"You guarantee I get my own body back?"
She was trying hard to sound casual, but there was no disguising the hunger in her voice.
"That's the deal?"
I glanced up at Ortega, who nodded.
"That's correct. If this comes off successfully, we'll be able to requisition it under a federal mandate. But it has to be successful. If we fuck up, we'll probably all go down the double barrel."
"You are operating under a federal brief, Lieutenant?"
Ortega smiled tightly.
"Not exactly. But under the UN Charter, we'll be able to apply the brief retrospectively, if, as I said, we are successful."
"A retrospective federal brief?"
Elliot looked back at me, brows raised.
"That's about as common as whale meat. This must be something gigantic."
"It is," I said. Elliot's eyes narrowed.
"And you're not with Jaxall anymore, are you?" "Who the fuck are you, Anderson?"
"I'm your fairy godmother, Elliot. Because if the lieutenant's requisition doesn't work out, I'll buy your sleeve back. That's a guarantee. Now, are you in or are you out?" Irene Elliott hung on to her detachment for a moment longer, a moment in which I felt my technical respect for her take on a more personal tone. Then she nodded.
"Tell me,"
she said. I told her. It took about half an hour to lay it out, while Ortega stood about or paced restlessly in and out of the bubble fab. I couldn't blame her. Over the past 10 days, she'd had to face the breakdown of practically every professional tenant she'd owned, and she was now committed to a project that, if it went wrong, offered a bristling array of 100-year or better storage offenses for all concerned. I think, without Bautista and the others behind her, she might not have risked it, even with her cordial hatred of the Meths, even for Riker. Or maybe I just tell myself that. Irene Elliott sat and listened in silence, broken only by 3 technical queries to which I had no answers. When I was finished, she said nothing for a long time. Ortega stopped her pacing and came to stand behind me, waiting.
"You're insane,"
Elliott said finally. "Can you do it?" She opened her mouth, then shut it again. Her face went dreamy, and I guessed she was reviewing a previous dipping episode from memory. After a few moments, she snapped back and nodded as if she might be trying to convince herself.
"Yes,"
she said slowly.
"It can be done. But not in real time. This isn't like rewriting your Fightrome friend's security system, or even downloading into that AI core. This makes what we did to the AI look like a systems check. To do this, to even attempt this, I've got to have a virtual forum."
"That's not a problem. Anything else?"
"That depends on what counter-intrusion systems Head in the Clouds is running."
Disgust and an edge of tears colored her tone for a couple of instants.
"You say this is a high-class whorehouse?"
"Very," Ortega said. Elliot's feelings went back underground.
"Then I'll have to run some checks. That'll take time."
"How much time?" Ortega wanted to know.
"Well, I can do it 2 ways.
professional scorn surfaced in her voice, scarring over the emotion that had been there before.
I can do a fast scan and maybe ring every alarm aboard this prick in the sky. Or I can do it right, which will take a couple of days. Your choice. We're running on your clock.
Take your time, I suggested, with a warning glance at Ortega. Now, what about wiring me for sight and sound? You know anyone who can do that discreetly?
Yeah, we got people here can do that. But you can forget a telemetry system. You try to transmit out of there, you will bring the house down. No pun intended.
She moved to the arm-mounted terminal and punched up a general access screen.
I'll see if Rhys can dig you up a grab-and-stash mic. Shielded microstack. You'll be able to record a couple of 100 hours high-res, and we can retrieve it here later.
Good enough. This gonna be expensive?
Elliot turned back to us, eyebrows raised.
Talk to Rhys. She'll probably have to buy the parts in, but maybe you can get her to do the surgery on a retrospective federal basis. She could use the juice at UN level.
I glanced at Ortega, who shrugged exasperatedly.
I guess, she said ungraciously, as Elliot busied herself with the screen.
I stood up and turned to the policewoman. Ortega, I muttered into her ear, abruptly aware that in the new sleeve I was completely unmoved by her scent. It isn't my fault we're short of funds. The Jaxall account's gone, evaporated. And if I start drawing on Bancroft's credit for stuff like this, it's going to look fucking odd. Now get a grip.
It isn't that,
she hissed back.
Then what is it?
She looked at me, at our brutally casual proximity.
You know goddamn well what it is.
I drew a deep breath and closed my eyes to avoid having to meet her gaze. Did you sort out that hardware for me?
Yeah.
She stepped back, voice returning to normal volume and empty of tone.
The stun gun from the Fell Street tackle room. No one will miss it. The rest is coming out of NYPD confiscated weapon stocks. I'm flying out to pick it up tomorrow personally. Material transaction, no records. I called in a couple of favors.
Good. Thanks.
Don't mention it.
Her tone was savagely ironic.
Oh, by the way, they had a hell of a time getting hold of the spider venom load. I don't suppose you'd care to tell me what that's all about, would you?
It's a personal thing. Elliot got someone on the screen. A serious-looking woman in a late-50s African sleeve.
Hey, Rhys, she said cheerfully. Got a customer for you.
Despite the pessimistic estimate, Irene Elliot finished her preliminary scan a day later. I was down by the lake, recovering from Rhys's simple microsurgery, and skimming stones with a girl of about 6 who seemed to have adopted me. Ortega was still in New York, the chill between us not really resolved. Elliot emerged from the encampment and yelled out the news of her successful covert scan without bothering to come down to the water's edge. I winced as the echoes floated out across the water. The open atmosphere of the little settlement took some getting used to, and how it fitted in with successful data piracy I still couldn't see. I handed my stone to the girl and rubbed reflexively at the tiny soreness under one eye, where Rhys had gone in and implanted the recording system.
Here, see if you can do it with this one.
Your stones are heavy, she said plaintively.
Well, try anyway. I got 9 skips out of the last one.
She squinted up at me.
You're wired for it. I'm only 6.
True, on both counts. I placed a hand on her head. But you gotta work with what you got.
When I'm big, I'm gonna be wired like Auntie Rhys.
I felt a small sadness well up on the cleanly swept floor of my Kamala Nurikam brain.
Good for you. Look, I've gotta go. Don't get too close to the water, right?
She looked at me exasperatedly.
I can swim.
So can I, but it looks cold, don't you think?
Yes.
There you are, then. I ruffled her hair and set off up the beach. At the first bubble fab, I looked back. She was hefting the big flat stone at the lake as if the water were an enemy. Elliot was in the expansive post-mission mood that most data rats seem to hit after a long spell cruising the stacks.
"I've been doing a little historical digging," she said, swinging the terminal arm outward from its resting place.
Her hands danced across the terminal deck, and the screen flared into life, shedding colors on her face.
"How's the implant?"
I touched my lower eyelid again. "Fine. Tapped straight into the same system that runs the time chip. Reese could have made a living doing this."
"She used to,"
Elliot said shortly.
"Till they busted her for anti-protectorate literature. When this is all over, you make sure that someone puts in a word for her at federal level, because she sure as shit needs it."
"Yeah," she said. I peered over her shoulder at the screen. "What have you got there?"
"Head in the clouds. Tampa Air Yard blueprints. Hull specs, the works. This stuff is centuries old. I'm amazed they still keep it on stack at all. Anyway, seems she was originally commissioned as part of the Caribbean Storm Management Flotilla, back before Sky Systems' orbital weather net put them all out of business. A lot of the long-range scanning equipment got ripped out when they refitted, but they left the local sensors in, and that's what provides basic skin security. Temperature pickups, infrared, that sort of thing. Anything with body heat lands anywhere on the hull, they'll know it's there."
I nodded, unsurprised. "Ways in?" She shrugged.
"Hundreds. Ventilation ducts, maintenance crawlways, take your pick."
I'll need to have another look at what Miller told my construct, but assume I'm going in from the top. Body heat's the only real problem?
"Yeah, but those sensors are looking for anything over a square millimeter of temperature differential. A stealth suit won't cover you. Christ, even the breath coming out of your lungs will probably trip them. And it doesn't stop there."
Elliot nodded somberly at the screen.
"They must have liked the system a lot, because when they refitted, they ran it through the whole ship. Room temperature monitors on every corridor and walkway."
"Yeah, Miller said something about a heat signature tag."
"That's it. Incoming guests get it on boarding, and their codes are incorporated into the system. Anyone else walks down a corridor uninvited, or goes somewhere their tag says they can't, they set off every alarm in the hull. Simple and very effective. And I don't think I can cut in there and write you a welcome code. Too much security."
"Don't worry about it," I said. "I don't think it's going to be a problem."
"You what?"
Ortega looked at me with fury and disbelief spreading across her face like a storm front. She stood away from me as I might be contagious. "It was just a suggestion. If you don't..."
"No."
She said the word as if it was new to her, and she liked the taste.
"No. No fucking way. I've connived a viral crime for you. I've hidden evidence for you. I've assisted you in multiple sleeving..."
"Hardly multiple."
"It's a fucking crime,"
she said through her teeth.
"I am not going to steal confiscated drugs out of police holding for you."
"Okay, forget it." I hesitated, put my tongue in my cheek for a moment. "Want to help me confiscate some more, then?" Something inside me cheered as the unwilling smile broke cover on her face. The dealer was in the same place he had been when I walked into his cast radius 2 weeks ago. This time I saw him 20 meters away, skulking in an alcove with a bad-eyed broadcast unit on his shoulder like a familiar. There were very few people on the street in any direction. I nodded to Ortega, who was stationed across the street, and walked on. The sales cast had not changed. The street of ridiculously ferocious women and the sudden cool of the beta-thenatine hit. But this time I was expecting it, and in any case, the Kamala Nurikam had a definite damping effect on the intrusion. I stepped up to the dealer with an eager smile.
"Got stiff, man."
"Good. That's what I'm looking for. How much have you got?" He started a little, expression coiling between greed and suspicion. His hand slipped down toward the horror box at his belt, just in case.
"How much you want, man?"
"All of it," I said cheerfully. "Everything you've got." He read me, but by then it was too late. I had the lock on two of his fingers as they stabbed at the horror box controls.
"Ah, ah."
He took a swipe at me with the other arm. I broke the fingers. He howled and collapsed around the pain. I kicked him in the stomach and took the horror box away from him. Behind me, Ortega arrived and flashed her badge at his sweat-beaded face.
"Bay City Police," she said laconically. "You're busted. Let's see what you've got, shall we?"
The beta-thenatine was in a series of dermal pads with tiny glass decanters folded in cotton. I held one of the vials up to the light and shook it. The liquid within was a pale red. "What do you reckon?" I asked Ortega. "About 8%?
"Looks like. Maybe less."
Ortega put a knee into the dealer's neck, grinding his face into the pavement.
"Where do you cut this stuff, pal?"
"This is good merchandise," the dealer squealed. "I buy direct. This is..."
Ortega rapped hard on his skull with her knuckles, and he shut up.
"This is shit," she said patiently. "This has been stepped on so hard it wouldn't give you a cold. We don't want it. So you can have your whole stash back and walk if you like. All we want to know is where you cut it. An address."
"I don't know any..."
"Do you want to be shot while escaping?"
Ortega asked him pleasantly, and he grew suddenly very quiet.
"Place in Oakland," he said sullenly.
Ortega gave him a pencil and paper.
"Write it down. No names, just the address. And so help me, if you're tinseling me, I'll come back here with 50 cc's of real stiff and feed you the lot unstepped."
She took back the scrawled paper and glanced at it, removed her knee from the dealer's neck, and patted him on the shoulder.
"Good. Now get up and get the fuck off the street. You can go back to work tomorrow if this is the right place. And if it's not, remember, I know your patch."
We watched him lurch off, and Ortega tapped the paper.
"I know this place. Controlled Substances busted them a couple of times last year, but some slick lawyer gets the important guys off every time. We'll make a lot of noise, let them think they're buying us off with a bag of uncut."
"Fair enough." I looked after the retreating figure of the dealer. "Would you have really shot him?"
"Nah," Ortega grinned. "But he doesn't know that. Consub does it sometimes, just to get major dealers off the street when there's something big going down. Official reprimand for the officer involved, and compensation pays out for a new sleeve. But it takes time, and the scumbag does that time in the store. Plus, it hurts to get shot."
"I was convincing, huh?" "Convince the fuck out of me."
"Maybe I should have been an envoy."
I shook my head. "Maybe you should spend less time around me." I stared up at the ceiling, waiting for the hypnophone sonicodes to lull me away from reality. On either side of me, Davidson, the organic damage data rat, and Ortega had settled into their racks, and even through the hypnophones I could hear them breathing, slow and regular, at the limits of my neurochem perception. I tried to relax more, to let the hypnosystem press me down through levels of softly decreasing consciousness, but instead, my mind was whirring through the details of the setup like a program check scanning for error. It was like the insomnia I'd suffered after Inanin, an infuriating synaptic itch that refused to go away. When my peripheral vision time display told me that at least a full minute had gone by, I propped myself up on one elbow and looked around at the figures dreaming in the other racks.
"Is there a problem?" I asked loudly.
"The tracking of Cheryl Bostock is complete,"
the hotel said.
"I assumed you would prefer to be alone when I informed you."
I sat upright and started picking the trodes off my body. "You assumed right. You sure everyone else is under?"
"Lieutenant Ortega and her colleagues were installed in the Virtuality approximately 2 minutes ago. Irene Elliott has been established there since earlier this afternoon. She asked not to be disturbed."
"What ratio are you running at the moment?"
11.15. Irene Elliott requested it."
I nodded to myself as I climbed out of the rack. 11.15 was a standard working ratio for data rats. It was also the title of a particularly bloody but otherwise unmemorable Mickey Nozawa Xperia flick. The only clear detail I could recall was that, unexpectedly, Mickey's character got killed at the end. I hoped it wasn't an omen. "All right," I said.
Let's see what you've got. Between the dimly seen heave and swell of the sea and the lights of the cabin, there was a lemon grove. I went along a dirt track between the trees, and the citrus fragrance felt cleansing. From the long grass on either side, cicadas whirred reassuringly. In a velvet sky above were stars like fixed gems, and behind the cabin the land rose into gentle hills and rocky outcroppings. The vague white forms of sheep moved in the darkness on the slopes, and from somewhere I heard a dog bark. The lights of a fishing village glimmered off to one side, less bright than the stars. There were hurricane lamps slung from the upper rail of the cabin's front porch, but no one was seated at the wooden tables there. The front wall bore a riotous abstract mural curling around and out from the luminous lettering of a sign that read, "Pension Flower of 68." Wind chimes dangled along the railing, winking and turning in the faint breeze that blew in from the sea. They made a variety of gentle sounds, from glassy belling to hollow wooden percussion. On the unkempt sloping lawn in front of the porch, someone had set out an incongruous collection of sofas and armchairs in a rough circle, so it looked as if the cabin had been lifted bodily off its furnished interior and set down again further up the slope. From the gathered seats came the soft sound of voices and the red embers of lit cigarettes. I reached for my own supply, realized I had neither the pack nor the need anymore, and grimaced wryly to myself in the dark. Bautista's voice rose above the murmur of conversation.
"Kovacs, that you?"
"Who else is it going to be?" I heard Ortega ask him impatiently. "This is a goddamn virtuality."
"Yeah, but..."
Bautista shrugged and gestured to the empty seats.
"Welcome to the party."
There were five figures seated in the circle of lounge furniture. Irene Elliott and Davidson were seated at opposite ends of a sofa, beside Bautista's chair. On the other side of Bautista, Ortega had sprawled her long-limbed body along the full length of a second sofa. The fifth figure was relaxed deep into another armchair, legs stretched out in front of him, face sunk in shadows. Wiry black hair stuck up in silhouette above a multicolored bandana. Lying across his lap was a white guitar. I stopped in front of him. "The Hendrix, right?"
"That's correct."
There was a depth and timbre to the voice that had been absent before. The big hands moved across frets and dislodged a tumble of chords into the darkened lawn.
"Bass entity projection, hardwired in by the original designers. If you strip down the client mirroring systems, this is what you get."
"Good." I took an armchair opposite Irene Elliott. "You happy with the working environment?" She nodded.
"Yeah, it's fine."
"How long have you been here?"
"Me?"
She shrugged.
"A day or so. Your friends got here a couple of hours ago."
"Two and a half," Ortega said sourly.
"What kept you?"
"Neurochem glitch." I nodded at the Hendrix figure. "Didn't he tell you?"
"That's exactly what he told us."
Ortega's gaze was wholly cop.
"I'd just like to know what it means."
I made a helpless gesture. "So would I. The Kamala system kept kicking me out of the pipe, and it took us a while to get compatibility. Maybe I'll mail the manufacturers." I turned back to Irene Elliott. "I take it you're going to want the format run up to maximum for the dip."
"You take it right."
Elliott jerked her thumb at the Hendrix figure.
"Man says the place runs to 323 max, and we are going to need every scrap of that to pull it off."
"You case the run yet?" Elliott nodded glumly.
"It's locked up tighter than an orbital bank, but I can tell you a couple of interesting things. One, your friend Sarah Sakalaska was DHF'd off Head in the Clouds 2 days ago, relayed off the gateway comsat out to Harlan's world. So she's out of the firing line."
"I'm impressed. How long did it take you to dig that up?"
"A while."
Elliott inclined her head in the Hendrix's direction.
"I had some help."
"And the second interesting thing?"
"Yeah. Covert needle cast to a receiver in Europe every 18 hours. can't tell you much more than that without dipping it, and I figured you wouldn't want that just yet. But it looks like what we're after.
I remembered the spider-like automatic guns and leathery impact-resistant womb sacks, the somber stone guardians that supported the roof of Kawahara's basilica, and I found myself once more smiling in response to those contemptuous hooded smiles. Well, then, I looked around at the assembled team. Let's get this gig off the ground. Chapter 40. It was Sharya, all over again. We dusted off from the Tower of the Hendrix an hour after dark, and swung away into the traffic-speckled night. Ortega had pulled the same Lakmi transport I'd ridden out to Suntouch House, but when I looked around the dimly lit interior of the ship's belly, it was the Envoy Command attack on Zahichi that I remembered. The scene was the same, Davidson playing the role of datacom officer, face washed pale blue by the light from his screen, Ortega as medic, unpacking the dermals and charging kit from a seal-wrapped bag. Up ahead in the hatchway to the cockpit, Bautista stood and looked worried, while another Mohican I didn't know did the flying. Something must have shown on my face, because Ortega leaned in abruptly to study my face. Problem? I shook my head. Just a little nostalgia. Well, I just hope you got these measures right. She braced herself against the hull. In her hand, the first dermal looked like a petal torn from some iridescent green plant. I grinned up at her and rolled my head to one side to expose my jugular. This is the 14%, she said, and applied the cool green petal to my neck. I felt the fractional grip like gentle sandpaper as it took, and then a long, cold finger leapt down past my collarbone and deep into my chest. Smooth. Fucking ought to be. You know how much that stuff would go for on the street? The perks of law enforcement, huh? Bautista turned around. That ain't funny, Kovach. Leave him alone, Rod, Ortega said lazily. Men's entitled to a bad joke under the circumstances. It's just nerves. I raised one finger to my temple in acknowledgement of the point. Ortega peeled back the dermal gingerly and stood back. 3 minutes till the next, she said. Right? I nodded complacently and opened my mind to the effects of the Reaper. At first it was uncomfortable. As my body temperature started to fall, the air in the transport grew hot and oppressive. It sank humidly into my lungs and lay there, so that every breath became an effort. My vision smeared, and my mouth turned uncomfortably dry as the fluid balance of my body seesawed. Movement, however small, began to seem like an imposition. Thought itself turned ponderous with effort. Then the control stimulants kicked in, and in seconds my head cleared from foggy to the unbearable brightness of sunlight on a knife. The soupy warmth of the air receded as neural governors retuned my system to cope with the body temperature shift. Inhaling became a languid pleasure, like drinking hot rum on a cold night. The cabin of the transport and the people in it were suddenly like a coded puzzle that I had the solution for if I could just... I felt an inane grin eating its way across my features. Whew, Kristen, this is good stuff. This is better than Sharya. Glad you like it. Ortega glanced at her watch. 2 more minutes. You up to it? I'm up to... I pursed my lips and blew through them. Anything. Anything at all. Ortega tipped her head back toward Bautista, who could presumably see the instrumentation in the cockpit. Rod, how long have we got? Be there in less than 40 minutes. Better get him in the suit. While Bautista busied himself with an overhead locker, Ortega delved in her pocket and produced a hypospray tipped with an unpleasant-looking needle. I want you to wear this, she said. Little bit of organic damage insurance for you. A needle?
I shook my head with what felt like machine precision.
Uh-uh. You're not sticking that fucking thing in me.
It's a tracer filament, she said patiently. And you're not leaving the ship without it.
I looked at the gleam on the needle, mine slicing the facts like vegetables for a bowl of ramen. In the tactical marines, we'd used subcutaneous filament to keep track of operatives on covert operations. In the event that something went wrong, it gave us a clear fix to pull our people out. In the event that nothing went wrong, the molecules of the filament broke down into organic residues, usually in under 48 hours. I glanced across at Davidson.
What's the range?
100 clicks. The young Mohican seemed suddenly very competent in the glow from his screen. Search-triggered signal only. It doesn't radiate unless we call you. Quite safe. I shrugged.
Okay. Where do you want to put it?
Ortega stood up, needle in hand.
Neck muscles. Nice and close to your stack, case they chop your head off.
Charming. I got to my feet and turned my back so that she could put the needle in. There was a brief spike of pain in the cords of muscle at the base of my skull, and then it faded. Ortega patted me on the shoulder.
You're done. Is he on screen?
Davidson punched a couple of buttons and nodded in satisfaction. In front of me, Bautista dumped the grav harness tackle on a seat. Ortega glanced at her watch and reached for the second dermal.
37%, she said. Ready for the big chill?
It was like being submerged in diamonds. By the time we hit head in the clouds, the drug had already eliminated most of my emotional responses, and everything had the sharp and shiny edges of raw data. Clarity became a substance, a film of understanding that coated all I saw and heard around me. The stealth suit and the grav harness felt like samurai armor, and when I drew the stun gun from its sheath to check the settings, I could feel the charge coiled in it like a tangible thing. It was the single forgiving phrase in the syntax of weaponry I had strapped about me. The rest were unequivocal sentences of death. The shard pistol, spider venom loaded, snugged across my lower ribs opposite the stunner. I dialed the muzzle aperture to wide. At 5 meters, it would take down a room full of opponents with a single shot, with no recoil and in complete silence. Sarah Sakalaska says, "Hi." The dispenser clip of termite microgrenades, each one not much larger or thicker than a data diskette, secured in a pouch on my left hip. In memoriam, Iphigenia Deme. The Tebbit knife on my forearm in its neural spring sheath beneath the stealth suit, like a final word. I reached for the cold feeling that had filled me up outside Jerry's closed quarters, and in the crystalline depths of the Reaper, did not need it. Mission time.
Target visual, the pilot called. You want to come up and have a look at this baby?
I glanced at Ortega, who shrugged, and the two of us went forward. Ortega seated herself beside the Mohican and slipped on the co-pilot's headset. I contented myself with standing next to Bautista in the access hatch. The view was just as good from there. Most of the Lockmit's cockpit was transparent alloy with instrumentation projected up onto it, permitting the pilot an uninterrupted view of the surrounding airspace. I remembered the feeling from Sharia, like riding a slightly concave tray, a tongue of steel or maybe a magic carpet, across the cloudscape below. A feeling that had been at once dizzying and godlike. I glanced at the Mohican's profile and wondered if he was as detached from that feeling as I was under the influence of the Reaper. There were no clouds tonight. Head in the clouds hung off to the left like a mountain village seen from afar. A cluster of tiny blue lights singing gently of homecoming and warmth in the icy black immensity. Kawahara seemed to have chosen the edge of the world for the whorehouse. As we banked toward the lights, a squiggle of electronic sound filled the cockpit, and the projected instrumentation dimmed briefly.
"That's it. We're acquired," Ortega said sharply. "Here we go, and with a flyby under the belly. Let them get a good look."
The Mohican said nothing, but
but the nose of the transport dipped. Ortega reached up to an instrument panel projected onto the transparency above her head and touched a button. A hard male voice crashed into the cabin.
"That you are in restricted airspace. We are under license to destroy intruding aircraft. Identify yourselves immediately."
"This is the Bay City Police Department," Ortega said laconically. "Look out your window and you'll see the stripes. We're up here on official police business, pal. So if you so much as twitch a launcher in this direction, I'll have you blown out of the sky." There was a hissing silence. Ortega turned to look at me and grinned. Ahead of us, head in the clouds, swelled like the target in a missile scope, and then lifted abruptly over our heads as the pilot dipped us below the bulk of its hull and banked about. I saw lights gathered like icy fruit on gantries and the undersides of landing pads, the distended belly of the vessel curving up on either side, and then we were past.
"State the nature of your business," the voice snapped nastily.
Ortega peered out of the side of the cockpit, as if looking for the speaker in amongst the airship superstructure. Her voice grew chilly. "Sonny, I've already told you the nature of our business. Now get me a landing pad." More silence. We circled the airship 5 kilometers out. I started to pull on the gloves of the stealth suit.
"Lieutenant Ortega."
It was Kawahara's voice this time, but in the depths of the beta-thenatine, even hatred seemed detached, and I had to remind myself to feel it. Most of me was assessing the rapidity with which they had voice-printed Ortega.
"This is a little unexpected. Do you have some kind of warrant? I believe our licenses are in order."
Ortega raised an eyebrow at me. The voice printing had impressed her, too. She cleared her throat.
"This is not a licensing matter. We are looking for a fugitive. If you're going to start insisting on warrants, I might have to assume you've got a guilty conscience."
"Don't threaten me, Lieutenant," Kawahara said coldly. "Do you have any idea who you're talking to?"
"Raylene Kawahara, I imagine."
In the deathly silence that followed, Ortega made a jubilant punching gesture at the ceiling and turned to grin at me. The barb had gone home. I felt the faintest ripple of amusement catch at the corners of my mouth.
"Perhaps you'd better tell me the name of this fugitive, Lieutenant."
Kawahara's voice had gone as smooth as the expression on an untenanted synthetic sleeve.
"His name is Takashi Kovach," Ortega said, with another grin at me. "But he's currently sleeved in the body of an ex-police officer. I'd like to ask you some questions concerning your relationship with this man."
There was another long pause, and I knew the lure was going to work. I crafted its multiple layers with all the care of the finest envoy deceit. Kawahara almost certainly knew of the relationship between Ortega and Riker, could probably guess Ortega's entanglement with the new tenant of her lover's sleeve. She would buy Ortega's anxiety at my disappearance. She would buy Ortega's unsanctioned approach to head in the clouds. Given an assumed communication between Kawahara and Miriam Bancroft, she would believe she knew where I was, and she would be confident that she had the upper hand over Ortega. But more important than all of this, she would want to know how the Bay City Police knew she was aboard Head in the Clouds. And since it was likely that they had, either directly or indirectly, gleaned the fact from Takashi Kovach, she would want to know how he knew. She would want to know how much he knew, and how much he had told the police. She would want to talk to Ortega. I fastened the wrist seals of the stealth suit and waited. We completed our third circuit at Head in the Clouds.
"You'd better come aboard," Kawahara said finally. "Starboard landing beacon. Follow it in. They'll give you a code."
The lockmit was equipped with a rear dispatch tube, a smaller civilian variant of the drop launcher that on military models was intended for smart bombs or surveillance drones. The tube was accessed through the floor of the main cabin, and with a certain amount of contortion, I fitted inside complete with stealth suit, grav harness, and assorted weaponry. We'd practiced this 3 or 4 times on the ground,
But now, with the transport swinging in toward head in the clouds, it suddenly seemed a long and complicated process. Finally, I got the last of the grav harness inside, and Ortega rapped once on the suit's helmet before she slammed the hatch down and buried me in darkness. 3 seconds later, the tube blew open and spat me backwards into the night sky. The sensation was a dimly remembered joy, something this sleeve did not recall at a cellular level. From the cramped confines of the tube and the noisy vibration of the transport's engines, I was suddenly blasted into absolute space and silence. Not even the rush of air made it through the foam padding on the suit's helmet as I fell. The grav harness kicked in as soon as I was clear of the tube and braked my fall before it got properly started. I felt myself borne up on its field, not quite motionless, like a ball bobbing on top of the column of water from a fountain. Pivoting about, I watched the navigation lights of the transport shrink inward against the bulk of head in the clouds. The airship hung above and before me like a threatening storm cloud. Lights glimmered out at me from the curving hull and the gantried superstructure beneath. Ordinarily, it would have given me the cringing sensation of being a sitting target, but the beta-thenatine soothed the emotions away in a clean rush of data detail. In the stealth suit, I was as black as the surrounding sky, and all but radar invisible. The grav field I was generating might theoretically show up on a scanner somewhere, but within the huge distortions produced by the airship's stabilizers, they'd need to be looking for me, and looking quite hard. All these things I knew with an absolute confidence that had no room for doubts, fears, or other emotional tangling. I was riding the Reaper. I set the impellers in cautious forward drive and drifted toward the massive curving wall of the hull. Inside the helmet, simulation graphics awoke on the surface of the visor, and I saw the entry points Irene Elliott had found for me, delineated in red. One in particular, the unsealed mouth of a disused sampling turret, was pulsing on and off next to a fine green lettering that spelled Prospect 1. I rose steadily upward to meet it. The turret mouth was about a meter wide, and scarred around the edges where the atmosphere sampling system had been amputated. I got my legs up in front of me, no mean achievement in a grav field, and hooked myself over the lip of the hatch, then concentrated on worming myself inside up to the waist. From there, I twisted onto my front to clear the grav harness, and was able to slide myself through the gap and onto the floor of the turret. I switched the grav harness off. Inside, there was barely enough crawl space for a technician lying on his back to check the nest of equipment. At the back of the turret was an antique airlock, complete with pressure wheel, just as Irene Elliott's dipped blueprints had promised. I wriggled around until I could grasp the wheel with both hands, conscious that both suit and harness were catching on the narrow hatchway, and that my exertions so far had almost totally depleted my immediate body strength. I drew a deep breath to fuel my comatose muscles, waited for my slowed heartbeat to pump the oxygen around my body, and heaved at the wheel. Against my expectations, it turned quite easily, and the airlock hatch fell outward. Beyond the hatch was an airy darkness. I lay still for a while, mustering more muscular strength. The two-shot Reaper cocktail was taking some getting used to. On Sharya, we hadn't needed to go above 20%. Ambient temperatures in Zahiche were quite high, and the spider tank's infrared sensors were crude. Up here, a body at Sharyan room temperature would set off every alarm in the hull. Without careful oxygen fueling, my body would rapidly exhaust its cellular-level energy reserves and leave me gasping on the floor like a gaffed bottleback. I lay still, breathing deep and slow. After a couple of minutes, I twisted around again and unfastened the grav harness, then slid carefully through the hatch and hit a steel grid walkway with the heels of my hands. I curled the rest of my body slowly out of the hatch, feeling like a moth emerging from a chrysalis. Checking the darkened walkway in either direction, I rose to my feet and removed the stealth suit helmet and gloves. If the keel plans Irene Elliott had dipped from the Tampa Air Yard stack were still accurate, The walkway led down among the huge helium silos to the vessel's aft buoyancy control room, and from there I'd be able to climb a maintenance ladder directly onto the main operating deck. According to what we'd patched together out of Miller's interrogation, Kawahara's quarters were two levels below on the port side. She had two huge windows that looked downward out of the hull. Summoning the blueprints from memory, I drew the shard pistol and set off toward the stern. It took me less than 15 minutes to reach the buoyancy control room, and I saw no one on the way. The control room itself appeared to be automated, and I began to suspect that these days hardly anyone bothered to visit the swooping canopies of the airship's upper hull. I found the maintenance ladder and climbed painstakingly down it until a warm, upward-spilling glow on my face told me I was almost on the operating deck. I stopped and listened for voices. Hearing and proximity sense both strained to their limits for a full minute before I lowered myself the final 4 meters and dropped to the floor of a well-lit, carpeted passageway. It was deserted in both directions. I checked my internal time display and stowed the shard gun. Mission time was accumulating. By now, Ortega and Kawahara would be talking. I glanced around at the decor and guessed that whatever function the operating deck had once been intended to serve, it wasn't serving it now. The passageway was decked out in opulent red and gold, with stands of exotic plant life and lamps in the form of coupling bodies every few meters. The carpet beneath my feet was deep and woven with highly detailed images of sexual abandon. Male, female, and variants between twined around each other along the length of the corridor in an unbroken progression of plugged orifices and splayed limbs. The walls were hung with similarly explicit hollow frames that gasped and moaned into life as I passed them. In one of them I thought I recognized the dark-haired, crimson-lipped woman of the Streetcast advertisement, the woman who might have pressed her thigh against mine in a bar on the other side of the globe. In the cold detachment of the betathenatine, none of it had any more impact than a wall full of Martian technoglyphs. There were plushly appointed double doors set into each side of the corridor at about 10-meter intervals. It didn't take much imagination to work out what was behind the doors. Jerry's biocabins, by any other name, and each door was just as likely as not to disgorge a client at any moment. I quickened my pace, searching for a connecting corridor that I knew led to stairs and elevators onto the other levels. I was almost there when a door 5 meters ahead of me swung open. I froze, hand on the grip of the shard gun, shoulders to the wall. Gaze gripped to the leading edge of the door. The Nurikem thrummed. In front of me, a gray-furred animal that was either half-grown wolf cub or dog emerged from the open door with arthritic slowness. I kept my hand on the shard gun and eased away from the wall, watching. The animal was not much over knee height, and it moved on all fours, but there was something badly wrong with the structure of the rear legs. Something wrenched. Its ears were laid back, and a minute keening came from its throat. It turned its head toward me, and for a moment my hand tightened on the shard gun. But the animal looked at me for only a moment, and the mute suffering in its eyes was enough to tell me I was in no danger. Then it limped painfully along the corridor to a room farther down on the opposite wall, and paused there, the long head down close to the door as if listening. With a dreamlike sense of lost control, I followed and leaned my own head against the surface of the door. The soundproofing was good, but no match for the Kamala Nurikem at full stretch. Somewhere down near the limits of hearing, noises trickled into my ear like stinging insects. A dull, rhythmic thudding sound, and something else that might have been the pleading screams of someone whose strength was almost gone. It stopped almost as soon as I had tuned it in. Below me, the dog stopped keening at the same moment and lay down on the ground beside the door. When I stepped away, it looked up at me once with a gaze of pure, distilled pain and reproach. In those eyes I could see reflected every victim that had ever looked at me in the last 3 decades of my waking life. Then the animal turned its head away and licked apathetically at its wounded rear legs. For a split second, something geysered through the cold crust of the betathenatine. I went back to the door the animal had emerged from, drawing the shard gun on my way, and swung through, holding the weapon in both hands before me. The room beyond was spacious and pastel-colored, with quaint two-dimensional framed pictures on the walls. A massive four-poster bed with translucent drapes occupied the center. Seated on the edge of the bed was a distinguished-looking man in his 40s, naked from the waist down. Above the waist, he appeared to be wearing formal evening dress, which clashed badly with the heavy-duty canvas work gloves he had pulled up to both elbows. He was bent over, cleaning himself between the legs with a damp white cloth. As I advanced into the room, he glanced up.
"Jack, you finished all—"
He stared at the gun in my hands without comprehension. Then, as the muzzle came to within half a meter of his face, a note of asperity crept into his voice.
"Listen, I didn't dial for this routine."
"On the house," I said dispassionately, and watched as the clutch of monomolecular shards tore his face apart. His hands flew up from between his legs to cover the wounds, and he flopped over sideways on the bed, gut-deep noises grinding out of him as he died. With the mission time display flaring red in the corner of my vision, I backed out of the room. The wounded animal outside the door opposite did not look up as I approached. I knelt and laid one hand gently on the matted fur. The head lifted, and the keening rose in the throat again. I set down the shard gun and tensed my empty hand. The neural sheath delivered the Tebbit knife, glinting. After, I cleaned the blade on the fur, resheathed the knife, and picked up the shard gun, all with the unhurried calm of the Reaper. Then I moved silently to the connecting corridor. Deep in the diamond serenity of the drug, something was nagging at me, but the Reaper would not let me worry about it. As indicated on Elliot's stolen blueprints, the cross corridor led to a set of stairs, now carpeted in the same orgiastic pattern as the main thoroughfare. I moved warily down the steps, gun tracking the open space ahead. Proximity sense spread like a radar net before me. Nothing stirred. Kawahara must have battened down all the hatches, just in case Ortega and her crew saw something inconvenient while they were on the premises. Two levels down, I stepped off the stairs and followed my memory of the blueprints through a mesh of corridors until I was reasonably sure that the door to Kawahara's quarters was around the next corner. With my back to the wall, I slid up to the corner and waited, breathing shallowly. The proximity sense said there was someone at the door around the corner, possibly more than one person, and I picked up the faint tang of cigarette smoke. I dropped to my knees, checked my surroundings, and then lowered my face to the ground. With one cheek brushing the pile of carpet, I eased my head around the corner. A man and a woman stood by the door, similarly dressed in green coveralls. The woman was smoking. Although each of them had stun guns holstered importantly at their belts, they looked more like technical staff than security attendants. I relaxed fractionally and settled down to wait some more. In the corner of my eye, the minutes of mission time pulsed like an overstressed vein. It was another quarter of an hour before I heard the door. At full amp, the Nurikem caught the rustle of clothing as the attendants moved to allow whoever was leaving to exit. I heard voices. Ortega's flat with pretended official disinterest, then Kawahara's, as modulated as the mandroid in Larkin and Green. With the beta-thenatine to protect me from the hatred, my reaction to that voice was a muted horizon event, like the flare and crash of gunfire at a great distance.
"That I cannot be of more assistance, Lieutenant. If what you say about the Y Clinic is true, his mental balance has certainly deteriorated since he worked for me. I feel a certain responsibility. I mean, I would never have recommended him to Lorenz Bancroft had I suspected this would happen."
"As I said, this is supposition." Ortega's tone sharpened slightly. "And I'd appreciate it if these details didn't go any further, until we know where Kovac has gone, and why."
"Quite. I quite understand the sensitivity of the matter. You are aboard Head in the Clouds, Lieutenant, We have a reputation for confidentiality.
Yeah.
Ortega allowed a strain of distaste into her voice.
I've heard that.
Well, then, you can rest assured that this will not be spoken of. Now, if you'll excuse me, Lieutenant, Detective Sergeant, I have some administrative matters to attend to. Tia and Max will see you back to the flight deck.
The door closed, and soft footfalls advanced in my direction. I tensed abruptly. Ortega and her escort were coming in my direction. That was something no one had bargained for. On the blueprints, the main landing pads were forward of Kawahara's cabin, and I'd come up on the aft side with that in mind. There seemed no reason to march Ortega and Bautista toward the stern. There was no panic. Instead, a cool analog of the adrenaline reaction rinsed through my mind, offering a chilly array of hard facts. Ortega and Bautista were in no danger. They must have arrived the same way they were leaving, or something would have been said. As for me, if they passed the corridor I was in, their escort would only have to glance sideways to see me. The area was well lit, and there were no hiding places within reach. On the other hand, with my body down below room temperature, my pulse slowed to a crawl, and my breathing at the same low, most of the subliminal factors that will trigger a normal human being's proximity sense were gone. Always assuming the escorts were wearing normal sleeves. And if they turned into this corridor to use the stairs I had come down by, I shrank back against the wall, dialed the shard gun down to minimum dispersal, and stopped breathing. Ortega, Bautista, the two attendants brought up the rear. They were so close I could have reached out and touched Ortega's hair. No one looked around. I gave them a full minute before I breathed again. Then I checked the corridor in both directions, went rapidly around the corner, and knocked on the door with the butt of the shard gun. Without waiting for a reply, I walked in.
Chapter 41. The chamber was exactly as Miller had described it, 20 meters wide and walled in non-reflective glass that sloped inward from roof to floor. On a clear day, you could probably lie on that slope and peer down thousands of meters to the sea below. The decor was stark and owed a lot to Kawahara's early millennium roots. The walls were smoke gray, the floor fused glass, and the lighting came from jagged pieces of origami performed in aluminum sheeting and spiked on iron tripods in the corners of the room. One side of the room was dominated by a massive slab of black steel that must serve as a desk. The other held a group of shale-colored loungers, grouped around an imitation oil drum brazier. Beyond the loungers, an arched doorway led out to what Miller had surmised were sleeping quarters. Above the desk, a slow-weaving holodisplay of data had been abandoned to its own devices. Raylene Kawahara stood with her back to the door, staring out at the night sky.
"Forget something?"
she asked distantly. "No, not a thing." I saw how her back stiffened as she heard me, but when she turned, it was with unhurried smoothness, and even the sight of the shard gun didn't crack the icy calm on her face. Her voice was almost as disinterested as it had been before she turned.
"Who are you? How did you get in here?"
"Think about it," I gestured at the loungers. "Sit down over there. Take the weight off your feet while you're thinking."
"Cadman?"
"Now you're insulting me. Sit down." I saw the realization explode behind her eyes.
"Kovach?"
An unpleasant smile bent at her lips.
"Kovach, you stupid, stupid bastard. Do you have any idea what you've just thrown away?"
"I said sit down."
"She was gone, Kovach. Back to Harlan's world. I kept my word. What do you think you're doing here?"
"I'm not going to tell you again," I said mildly. "Either you sit down now or I'll break one of your kneecaps." The thin smile stayed on Kawahara's mouth as she lowered herself a centimeter at a time onto the nearest lounger.
"Very well, Kovach. We'll play to your script tonight. And then I'll have that fishwife Sokolovska dragged all the way back here and you with her. What are you going to do? Kill me?
If necessary.
For what? Is this some kind of moral stand?
The emphasis Kawahara laid on the last two words made it sound like the name of a product.
Aren't you forgetting something? If you kill me here, it'll take about 18 hours for the remote storage system in Europe to notice, and then re-sleeve me from my last update cast. And it won't take the new me very long to work out what happened up here.
I seated myself on the edge of the lounger. Oh, I don't know. Look how long it's taken Bancroft, and he still doesn't have the truth, does he?
Is this about Bancroft?
No, Raylene. This is about you and me. You should have left Sarah alone. You should have left me alone while you could.
Oh,
she cooed, mock maternal.
Did you get manipulated? I'm sorry.
She dropped the tone just as abruptly.
You're an envoy, Kovac. You live by manipulation. We all do. We all live in the great manipulation matrix, and it's just one big struggle to stay on top.
I shook my head. I didn't ask to be dealt in.
Kovac, Kovac.
Kawahara's expression was suddenly almost tender.
None of us asked to be dealt in. You think I asked to be born in Fission City, with a web-fingered dwarf for a father and a psychotic whore for a mother? You think I asked for that? We're not dealt in, we're thrown in, and after that it's just about keeping your head above water.
Or pouring water down other people's throats, I agreed amiably. I guess you took after your mother, right? For a second it was as if Kawahara's face was a mask cut from tin behind which a furnace was raging. I saw the fury ignite in her eyes, and if I had not had the Reaper inside to keep me cold, I would have been afraid.
Kill me,
she said, tight-lipped,
and make the most of it, because you are going to suffer, Kovac. You think those sad-case revolutionaries on New Beijing suffered when they died? I'm going to invent new limits for you and your fish-smelling bitch.
I shook my head. I don't think so, Raylene. You see, your update needlecast went through about 10 minutes ago, and on the way, I had it dipped. Didn't lift anything. We just spliced the Rawling virus onto the cast. It's in the core by now, Raylene. Your remote storage has been spiked. Her eyes narrowed.
You're lying.
Not today. You like the work Irene Elliott did at Jack It Up? Well, you should see her in a virtual forum. I bet she had time to take a half dozen mind bites while she was inside that needle cast. Souvenirs. Collector's items, in fact, because if I know anything about stack engineers, they'll weld down the lid on your remote stack faster than politicians leaving a war zone. I nodded over at the winding data display. I should think you'd get the alarm in another couple of hours. It took longer at In-N-In, but that was a long time ago. The technology's moved on since then. Then she believed, and it was as if the fury I'd seen in her eyes had banked down to a concentrated white heat.
Irene Elliott, she said intently. When I find her...
I think we've had enough empty threats for one day, I interrupted without force. Listen to me. Currently the stack you're wearing is the only life you have, and in the mood I'm in now it wouldn't take much to make me cut it out of your spine and stamp on it. Before or after I shoot you, so shut up. Kawahara sat still, glaring at me out of slitted eyes. Her top lip drew fractionally back off her teeth for a moment, before control asserted itself.
What do you want?
Better. What I want right now is a full confession of how you set Bancroft up. Resolution 653, Mary Lou Hinchley, the whole thing. You can throw in how you framed Riker as well.
Are you wired for this?
I tapped my left eyelid where the recording system had gone in and smiled.
You really think I'm going to do this?
Kawahara's rage glinted at me from behind her eyes. She was waiting, coiled for an opening. I had seen her like this before, but then I hadn't been on the receiving end of that look. I was in as much danger under those eyes as I had ever been under fire in the streets of Sharia.
You really think you're going to get this from me?
Look on the bright side, Raylene. You can probably buy and influence your way out of the erasure penalty. And for the rest, you might get only a couple of 100 years in the store. My voice hardened. Whereas, if you don't talk, you'll die right here and now.
Confession under duress is inadmissible under UN law.
Don't make me laugh. This isn't going to the UN. You think I've never been in a court before? You think I trust lawyers to deal with this? Everything you say here tonight is going express needle cast to World Web One as soon as I'm back on the ground. That, and footage of whoever it was I wasted in the doggy room upstairs. Kawahara's eyes widened and I nodded. Yeah, I should have said earlier. You're a client down. Not really dead, but he'll need resleeving. Now, with all that, I reckon about 3 minutes after Sandy Kim goes live. The UN tacks are going to be blowing down your door with a fistful of warrants. They'll have no choice. Bancroft alone will force their hand. You think the same people who authorized Sharia and Inanin are going to stick at a little constitutional rule-bending to protect their power base? Now, start talking. Kawahara raised her eyebrows, as if this was nothing more than a slightly distasteful joke she'd just been told.
Where would you like me to start, Takashi-san?
Mary Lou Hinchley. She fell from here, right?
Of course.
You had her slated for the snuff deck? Some sick fuck wanted to pull on the tiger sleeve and play kitty?
Well, well.
Kawahara tipped her head on one side as she made connections.
Who have you been talking to? Someone from the Y Clinic, is it? Let me think. Miller was here for that little object lesson, but you torched him, so... Oh, you haven't been headhunting again, Takashi. You didn't take Philippe Miller home in a hatbox, did you?
I said nothing, just looked at her over the barrel of the shard gun, hearing again the weakened screaming through the door I'd listened at. Kawahara shrugged.
It wasn't the tiger, as it happens, but something of that sort, yes?
And she found out?
Somehow, yes.
Kawahara seemed to be relaxing, which under normal circumstances would have made me nervous. Under the beta-thenatine, it just made me more watchful.
A word in the wrong place, maybe something a technician said. You know, we usually put our snuff clients through a virtual version before we let them loose on the real thing. It helps to know how they're going to react, and in some cases we even persuade them not to go through with it.
Very thoughtful of you. Kawahara sighed.
How do I get through to you, Takashi? We provide a service here. If it can be made legal, then so much the better.
That's bullshit, Raylene. You sell them the virtual, and in a couple of months they come sniffing after the real thing. There's a casual link, and you know it. Selling them something illegal gives you leverage, probably over some very influential people. Get many UN governors up here, do you? Protectorate generals, that kind of scum?
Head in the clouds caters to an elite.
Like that white-haired fuck I greased upstairs? He was someone important, was he?
Carlton McCabe?
From somewhere, Kawahara produced an alarming smile.
You could say that, I suppose, yes. A person of influence.
Would you care to tell me which particular person of influence you'd promise they could rip the innards out of Mary Lou Hinchley? Kawahara tautened slightly.
No, I would not.
Suppose not. You want that for a bargaining line later, won't you? Okay, skip it. So what happened? Hinchley was brought up here, accidentally found out what she was being fattened up for and tried to escape? Stole a grav harness, perhaps?
I doubt that. The equipment is kept under tight security. Perhaps she thought she could cling to the outside of one of the shuttles. She was not a very bright girl, apparently. The details are still unclear, but she must have fallen somehow.
Or jumped. Kawahara shook her head.
I don't think she had the stomach for that. Mary Lou Hinchley was not a samurai spirit. Like most of common humanity, she would have clung to life until the last undignified moment, hoping for some miracle, begging for mercy.
How inelegant. Was she missed immediately?
Of course she was missed. She had a client waiting for her. We scoured the ship.
Embarrassing?
Yes.
But not as embarrassing as having her wash up on the shore a couple of days later, huh? The luck fairies were out of town that week.
It was unlucky,
Kawahara conceded, as if we were discussing a bad hand of poker.
But not entirely unexpected. We were not anticipating a real problem.
You knew she was Catholic?
Of course. It was part of the requirements.
So when Riker dug up that iffy conversation, you must have shat yourself. Hinchley's testimony would have dragged you right into the open, along with fuck knows how many of your influential friends. Head in the clouds, one of the houses indicted for snuff, and you with it. What was the word you used on New Beijing that time? Intolerable risk. Something had to be done. Riker had to be shut down. Stop me if I'm losing the thread here.
No, you're quite correct.
So you framed him? Kawahara shrugged again.
An attempt was made to buy him off. He proved unreceptive.
Unfortunate. So what did you do then?
You don't know?
I want to hear you say it. I want details. I'm doing too much of the talking here. Try to keep your end of the conversation up, or I might think you're being uncooperative.
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.